Sunny skies at 83 degrees. Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott, and we'll begin with this. Monday night, about 300 people attended a campus-sanctioned vigil for Georgia Tech student Scout Schultz. But after the vigil, nearly 100 protesters marched to the campus police department. One police vehicle was destroyed after being set on fire. Two officers suffered minor injuries, and three people were arrested and charged with inciting a riot and battery of an officer. Now, campus police shot and killed Scout Schultz on Saturday. Investigators with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation say the 21-year-old computer engineering student was a person who initially made the 911 call. Joining me now in studio with more is WABE's Lisa Hagan. Lisa, thanks for taking the time.
Hi, Rose.
You were out last night. Let's begin there. Were all of these protesters, were they all Georgia Tech students?
No. And of course, you know, I didn't get to talk to every single person in the crowd, about 100 folks maybe from what I saw. Some were students, some were former students, and I think there were also a number of people who knew Scout Schultz through their activism. Mm-hmm. They were very politically active.
You've been talking to students. Obviously, they have concerns regarding this tragic event. What have you heard?
A lot of concerns about mental health. That's number one, about access to counseling, about, you know, the police response, of course, to this, whether or not the officers had crisis intervention training. So a lot of questions about what kind of support LGBTQ students get on campus. And it's been very difficult to get any sort of response from the school out of this, of course. But that's definitely what I've been hearing.
You know, as far as the investigation, we know the GBI is handling the case, but there are conflicting reports, Lisa, regarding the actions of Scout Schultz right before being shot by the officer, and whether or not it was a knife blade, was it extended? What have you heard?
Right. So to be clear, that this object was a multi-tool. It's one of those things with with pliers, screwdrivers,
etc. Bottle opener and all
that. It contained a blade. Now, the GBI has confirmed to me that the blade was not out when police officers first got there. They have not told me whether or not it ever came out. And, you know, investigation is ongoing. A lot of things are changing minute to minute here.
And Lisa, the GBI has already released some information regarding Schultz, including an attempted suicide from some time ago, and also allegedly some suicide notes found in his dormitory room. Have you been able to confirm that?
Their dormitory room. Yeah. So absolutely. You know, the family has also talked about a Scout being treated for depression in the past, that they had an earlier suicide attempt. So there do seem to be, and you know, the video shows them saying, shoot me. There do seem to be a lot of signs pointing to a mental health issue here.
So what's next here after the GBI concludes its investigation? Then what?
You know, it's going to be the sort of a similar pattern that we often see. It's going to be a slow investigation. These things need to move slowly. But, you know, even the father of Scout Schultz yesterday was saying, we're not particularly confident that we're going to see justice in one of these cases. You know, we just had this case of a St. Louis officer being acquitted for killing someone. Mm-hmm. This is a thing that we see pretty often.
And Schultz's family, you mentioned, they say they want answers. They've already hired an attorney, correct?
That's right. And that attorney has said they will be pressing a civil case. That attorney's represented a lot of police shooting cases, from Alton Sterling, Walter Scott, Chase Sherman. So we'll see what happens next with that.
From our WABE News Department, Lisa Hagan, who's covering the shooting death of Georgia Tech student Scout Schultz. Lisa, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Rose.
We'll have more regarding the death of Schultz throughout this program. This is Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from LeapFrog, offering managed IT services and solutions designed to help businesses leverage technology to achieve their business goals. More information is available at leapfrogservices.com. LeapFrog, extraordinary IT services. And from Reliable Heating and Air, a Train dealer, a family company since 1978, offering heating and air, plumbing, electrical, and duct cleaning 24 hours a day. Learn more at reliableair.com.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Under President Obama, the Justice Department sought to hold police accountable for civil rights violations. The new head of the department, Jeff Sessions, has a different focus.
President Trump has issued executive orders to the Department of Justice directing us to support our state and local law enforcement.
That's next time on Here and Now, this afternoon at 3 on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. As the investigation continues into the shooting death of student Scout Schultz, questions have been raised as to the mental state of the computer engineering major. Now Monday, family attorney Chris Stewart was asked about Schultz's mental history.
We won't go into too much detail other than that Scout battled with depression in the past. You know of the one incident a year, 2 years ago, but Scout was still doing great in school.
That one incident, according to the GBI, was an attempted suicide. But the attorney, Chris Stewart, says last Saturday, Scout Schultz was not himself.
What was Scout doing that day? Standing there, disoriented, having a mental breakdown, and was shot from 20 feet away. We went out there and measured.
The dialogue about how the police should handle situations like this is always ongoing. But when it comes to policing on college campuses, should there be a different approach? Well, joining me in studio is Marvin Reddick, a former law enforcement officer, including 5 years as a detective at Georgia Tech. He has over 25 years of experience, now retired. Marvin, welcome. Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate that.
Thanks for having me here. Good to see you again.
Let's begin with this. How hard is it to describe for folks like me, you know, non-law enforcement people, what that moment feels like for an officer when encountering a situation? And I want to be clear, not necessarily a person who has a hostage or who has a weapon, or but a situation where the person is disoriented or just having some type of breakdown. How difficult is it for that officer? Put us in that mindset in that moment.
Okay, when you're dealing with a suspect that exemplifying possible mental challenges, it's very hard. It's uniquely hard because you have to bring yourself up emotionally for every call you get, because there's no such thing as a routine call. Mm-hmm. And that's one problem. But when there's no predictability, because you can't diagnose this person right here, you don't know what they're dealing with, so you have to be ready for anything. And in a lot of cases where it turns out to be not much, that has no bearing on the emotions that you just dealt with. Mm-hmm. And so that's what it's like dealing with situations like that.
And for each officer, it's different. I take it.
For every officer, it's different. People process emotions differently. The big problem with law enforcement officers from an emotional standpoint is they don't terminate. As you know, emotions have to terminate. And on a given night, if you get 20 calls, then you're going to go to that same adrenal dump situation 25 times. Mm-hmm. And if nothing happens in these situations, then they don't go away. They tend to churn. And so that's why you see over a course of time, officers get a little quicker on the draw, a little mm-hmm. a shorter fuse.
Can you recall a time when you had to make the decision to fire your weapon, and did you regret it at all?
Well, regardless of the justification, it's regrettable. And yes, I have had to deploy my weapon, and you regret even being in the situation. You regret your choice to go into law enforcement at that time. You wish this situation had never happened, you know. And I always joke about it. I got into it for the free donuts and chicken. Mm-hmm. But that's just one of the challenging parts about it.
Was the individual or individuals, were they armed or unarmed in that situation?
Well, over 25 years, if you police the longest I did, you're going to deal with armed situation, mm-hmm. unarmed situations, and even situation where a person that's so large, it's the same thing as this mm-hmm. person being armed. So, and it's just, it can be challenging.
We hear this term clear and present threat. Mm-hmm. And how do you define that? Or how is it defined in terms of law enforcement? If someone is a clear and present threat and that leads to an officer making that decision to fire his or her weapon, how do you define that?
Well, what's the protocol more specifically in the state of Georgia is AOJ, ability, opportunity, and jeopardy. Now, of course, this is a decision that you have a split second to make, but those three things have to be present before you can take an action, like especially with deploying a weapon.
Let's go through this. Ability being?
The person has to have the ability to do something to you or others that would cause egregious bodily harm or death.
Okay.
So if this person has a weapon, or this person is of substantial size, or if there are several people, then you can say they have the ability. Now, the opportunity basically means you have to be there and mm-hmm. be within reach. Now, we're talking about a edge weapon situation here, potentially. Mm-hmm. So that's a 21-feet protocol in the state of Georgia. It is said that this person 21 feet away can get to you before you can draw your weapon in most cases.
Really?
Yes.
21 feet.
21 feet. And with that being said, I think most of that is that you can get your weapon out and deploy it, but if this person is charging towards you, he's still going to continue. Mm-hmm. You're not going to necessarily stop him. And then the jeopardy, in other words, is this person attempting to take your life, or they are in the process of doing mm-hmm. it? So those three things have to be present before you can take that action. And it may sound like, oh,
how can you process all of that in the heat of the moment if you're an officer?
Well, training, mm-hmm. Experience, and this is what you do. You know, just like what you're doing in here, you're a lot better at it than I am, you know, because this is what you do. So that's the choice that we made. We chose to put the badge on, and we could quit at any time, okay? So the scrutiny that comes behind it, we accept all of that. That's the nature of the job.
Although it's not surveillance video, but it was shot from nearby. You've watched that video that's mm-hmm. been circulating. What are your thoughts on what took place?
Well, I like to be careful with my thoughts because I don't want to be unfair to the officers.
Sure.
Or to the family. But from what I saw, and I only watched it once because I try not to watch things like that anymore, the situation was being handled by, let's say, the point officer, the gentleman that was speaking with him, as good as it could be handled in given the situation. They didn't have tasers or any less lethal abilities. Mm-hmm. He would back away when the person walked towards him, and Mr. Schultz walked towards him, and he would give him a loud verbal command to discontinue what he's doing. And a situation like that can go on for hours. You mm-hmm. know, if you don't have a duty to protect anyone, and if you're not necessarily trying to keep this person from escaping, that can go on. But the officer that actually fired the shot did not demonstrate the same patience, if you will. Mm-hmm.
Because there was more than one officer on
the scene. There was more than one officer on the scene. So when he walks towards the initial officer, I saw on several occasions where he just backed away and raised his voice, and Mr. Schultz sort of digressed or regressed. But from what I could see, he didn't really get the same leniency from mm-hmm. the other officer.
The voice you hear is Marvin Reddick. He's a former law enforcement officer, including 5 years as a detective at Georgia Tech. He has over 25 years of experience in law enforcement. And Marvin, when you were on campus, and even in your career as an officer, did you have to take special resource training because it was a campus environment? Because you're dealing with young folks, in a sense.
Yes. As a Georgia Tech police officer, the state of Georgia does offer campus police training, and we definitely had that, and they do offer crisis intervention training, and I did have that, and I also had hostage negotiation training, mm-hmm. which a lot of these situations wind up with a barricaded individual where you have to do a lot of talking. Mm-hmm. Now, is this across the board? Is everybody required to get this? No.
Sure.
Except for the campus police training, and I think that they should. In law enforcement, you know, it's the most widely diverse profession on this planet. You can be a sheriff deputy and never write a traffic ticket. Mm-hmm. You could be a U.S. Marshal and not know anything about what a municipal officer does. So you have to do things that are germane to your branch of law enforcement. And as a campus police officer, those are some of the things that you need to consider. Your training with dealing with crisis mm-hmm. has to be the best. And believe it or not, a campus police officer has to be the best at deploying his weapon and the best at using that discretion. Simply because at Georgia Tech, for instance, or Georgia Tech specifically, there are more pedestrians on that campus in the middle of the day than anywhere else in the city of Atlanta.
It's right in the middle of a major city. Yeah.
So you can't unblow a whistle and you can't get that bullet back. So you have to be very good in your discretion as to whether you shoot or not, and very good when you're shooting to make sure that you hit your intended target, because people are all over the place.
Mm-hmm. According to Georgia Tech, police officers do not carry tasers. Does that surprise you, particularly because it is a campus environment?
It doesn't surprise me because I work there. Mm-hmm. But it was surprising to me that I was on a college campus and they didn't have less lethal force. I mean, you have several things that I've even suggested that we needed there at Georgia Tech. You need tasers. Mm-hmm. Of course, you need anything less lethal. You need water cannons. See, in situations like this, a water cannon can suppress a person, knock a person down. They give officers an opportunity to apprehend the person. So the officers in this situation, they used what they had. And that's where you look at a Georgia Tech and say, well, why didn't you give them more things to work with, given the fact you have young people that are just starting their lives out and are more prone to get involved in alcohol and a lot of mental issues going on with young people.
Let me ask your opinion on this, because we just had the campus carry legislation that was signed into law. Also, could you understand if the officer is thinking, although I don't see a gun, perhaps this person may have one? I mean, that's pure speculation, but do you think all this could come in play for officers when they're now encountering situations like this for those campuses where guns are allowed?
Well, one thing you have to do as an officer when you're coming up on the scene, you have to do sort of an acting technique called clearing your canvas. You have to get all the speculation, supposition, and all that out of your mind, because you want to go in a situation fresh. Do they think about guns being on campus? Yeah, they do. Were there guns on campus before the law was passed? Yes, there were. So you have to look purely at this individual, not what he did prior, okay? Not what he has the potential to do, what he has here, and you have to isolate.
This raises a lot of questions in terms of not just guns on campus, but then how law enforcement handles situations where the individual or individuals may have some type of mental impairment. Do you think this will change at all in terms of training? You know, if you were, and you're not Chief Conley, who was over at Georgia Tech, but if you were the chief, what changes would you want to make after something like this?
Well, I would definitely start with less lethal force, because the most egregious thing that we're talking about here is the fact that we have a child, even though he's 21, that's dead. And there could have been an opportunity for him to be alive and gotten help and gone on with his life. So less lethal force, number one. The psychological training, crisis intervention training across the board, and with the idea of needing to be the best at it, because we're on a campus with a lot of this going on. And those are two of the places that I would start.
Marvin Reddick is a former law enforcement officer, including 5 years as a detective at Georgia Tech. We've been talking about policing in a college campus environment after the shooting death of Georgia Tech student Scout Schultz. Now retired, thank you for coming in and taking the time.
You're quite welcome, anytime.
Thank you. If you missed any part of today's show, we got you. You can catch up on all the interviews you missed at wabe.org/closerlook. And let me know what you think. Tweet me at WABE Rose Scott or send an email to rose@wabe.org. This is member support at 90.1 WABE Atlanta.
My name is Dowie Dolman. I live in Tucker. I actually just moved to Georgia because of family, girlfriend, and a better opportunity for job-wise. My first impression is there's a lot more stuff you can do besides, you know, just staying at home. It's a lot of activities, you know. I would describe Tucker, Georgia as, you know, it's a spot where it's very convenient, you know. It's away from the expensive apartments in downtown Atlanta. It's cheaper, and also it's right where it's not busy, where the traffic is hectic.
The new book, One Nation After Trump, starts with this sentence. American democracy was never supposed to give the nation a president like Donald Trump. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the authors E.J. Dionne and Norm Ornstein. They believe that this subsequent period of national soul-searching could lead to an era of democratic renewal. Join us this evening at 7 on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. I'm Rose Scott. Nearly 15 to 20% of breast cancers in the U.S. are a form called triple negative breast cancer. Now, that's according to the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation. It is an aggressive form of cancer that occurs more often in African American and young women. And it's the focus of a conference currently underway here in Atlanta, which is being hosted by Georgia State University. And joining me now to talk more about this aggressive form of breast cancer is Dr. Padmasri Rita. Thank you so much for coming in and taking the time. You're a senior research scientist at the university, correct?
That's correct.
So this is the first international conference that solely is going to focus on what's called triple negative breast cancer. Now, for our listeners, tell us exactly what that is.
So as the name suggests, triple negative breast tumors generally test negative for the three factors or biomarkers that we would normally test all breast tumors for in the clinic. So in effect, we are defining or describing these tumors based on what they lack. And now that's not very useful clinically. Mm-hmm. It would be more useful if you knew what they had that was problematic that we could address or do something about. But, you know, currently these disease and the other thing about triple negative breast cancer is it's not one disease. It's a whole constellation of hundreds of diseases.
Really?
Yeah. And the reason for that is if you just think about it, if I describe the fish in a tank as these fish are not red, not green, not mm-hmm. blue. They could be orange, black, brown, striped, spotted. So it's a catch-all phrase, and it includes a very diverse group of patients, diverse in terms of their molecular profiles, gene expression patterns, and more importantly, their clinical behavior.
And that's why this is referred to as a very complex form of breast cancer.
Yes, it's quite mind-boggling, the diversity and the heterogeneity in behavior that the clinicians have to face day after day. It's quite mind-boggling.
Is it so complex that it's often, I guess, diagnosed after a regular treatment of cancer? Because it's called an aggressive, more aggressive than any other breast cancer.
Yes. The main reason why we describe it as being aggressive is that it has a high tendency to spread rapidly to around the body. Mm-hmm. And what we see most often is that patients who, after treatment, after surgery, there's a high chance of reoccurrence, relapse, and spread within the first 5 years of diagnosis.
But so with a triple negative breast cancer, it's coming back, but not. It wasn't triple negative to begin with. Is that what you're saying?
No, it was triple negative to begin with, and the patient most likely had the tumor removed, and maybe they had chemotherapy, radiation, but then it comes right back. It has a high tendency to come back within 5 years, and that's a big problem.
And therein lies the research, because you're all trying to figure out why, or do we know why?
As I mentioned, these tumors are this disease is there's a lot of diversity in this disease, and there are major critical gaps in our knowledge. We don't know enough about the biology of this disease. We don't know enough about the factors that affect its course in individual patients, and more importantly, we still don't have good targets for treatment. There are very limited treatment options now for TNBC patients. Right now, it's just surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. And there are no other targeted treatments. In this era of precision medicine, there are currently no approved targeted treatment for this big group of patients. And therein, there's a great unmet need for people to come together and identify some robust targets.
Which is why you all are having this conference.
Yes. And the other important reason is that in the United States, there's a very striking racial disparity mm-hmm. in outcomes related to breast cancer.
And we're talking about this form of cancer is 2 to 3 times more likely to be found in people with African ancestry.
That is correct. And so that straight away tells you that there is a big genetic component or predisposition that can be linked to African genetic ancestry, but that doesn't mean that there aren't other factors. There are a host of other factors that are also, we are learning now that they also could contribute to the risk of developing this particular aggressive subtype, as well as these factors could also affect when a person has the subtype, the actual tumor biology of their individual tumor. Mm-hmm. For example, we are learning that other conditions, comorbid conditions like diabetes or reproductive factors, diet, lifestyle choices, all of these could potentially affect the risk of developing TNBC or affect the tumor biology.
That connection in terms of African ancestry, coupled with what you just talked about, y'all have been studying for several years now at Georgia State.
Yes.
Are you having to go around the globe? Have you been to the continent of Africa where you've had to do some study and research there as well?
Yes, that's a very good question. So we've conducted several multi-institutional studies here in the United States looking at the differences between the profile of this disease in African-Americans versus in European-American white women. And we see striking differences. But the problem is that what we have in terms of medical records is what the patients identify their race as. Mm-hmm. And that is not tightly correlated with genetic ancestry. And we know that the African American population in the U.S. is genetically mixed. Mm-hmm. They do have a significant proportion, almost 20-25% of European ancestry mixed. So we really cannot dissect out the contribution of African genetic ancestry unless we had samples from indigenous African, native African patients. And it was the search for these very vital samples that took us all the way to Nigeria. And our group has now established a global consortium, actually, which includes a network of 15 teaching hospitals across the length and breadth of Nigeria and one hospital in Ghana. And we are currently, all the investigators have come together and expressed their commitment to what we have established as a consortium. It's called ICART, mm-hmm. International Consortium for Advancing Research on Triple Negative Breast Cancer. And these hospitals have committed to contribute their samples to research. And these will be extremely important for understanding the contribution of African ancestry.
And so the samples they're taking from Nigerian women, and you all are either putting that alongside under the scope with African-American women here in the United States.
Exactly.
What have you found so far?
First of all, the profile of, we see some striking similarities between the profile of triple negative tumors amongst African-Americans and women in Nigeria. These studies are still very preliminary. They're mm-hmm. in their early stages because this consortium was only born a year and a half ago. And it's only now that we are getting the samples together, designing these multi-institutional studies and bringing together the expertise of diverse scientists and clinicians and epidemiologists to tackle this scourge.
And I imagine also clinical trials or getting people to participate is vital as well. How challenging is that in this country?
That is a very significant challenge, and a big part of that challenge is ensuring that there is sufficient enrollment of African American women in these trials. It is well known now that African Americans are highly underrepresented in clinical trials of investigational agents. Mm-hmm. As a result of that, we are, you know, when we try to personalize treatments, we have to take into account the influence of their ancestry. How can you personalize when the trial, if the trial population is predominantly European American, how applicable are those treatments or those biomarkers that you use to make important clinical decisions in an African American person?
And how difficult and challenging it is to be able to even trace your ancestry outside of this country. For some, we've been able to, you know, I mean, you can do the DNA test,
yes.
You know, but other than that, you know, it's a challenge. Often we hear about any form of cancer, obviously early detection is key, but with this case, this form of cancer, it's showing up in women in their late 20s and 30s.
Yes, and I cannot overemphasize the importance of early and accurate diagnosis. And this is where access to healthcare, access to high quality care, all these can make a huge difference in awareness as well.
But, you know, there's something we've talked about on this program also, Dr. Rita, and that is that with the ever-changing guidelines for women as it relates to when to get your mammogram and at what age, and it keeps changing. And for women of color, it's changed. I remember a few years ago, they said, you know, maybe in your middle to late 20s. And they said, no, maybe your 30s or 40s. So what is someone like me to do?
Well, that's one of the purposes of this conference, to serve as a call for action, mm-hmm. To consider the patient holistically, family history, race, lifestyle, risk factors. Everything has to be factored in, and the practitioner has to know when to recommend the first primary screen, mm-hmm. how frequently the patient should be screened, and one shoe just cannot fit all. We have to customize it based on the individual, and that's where access to good quality healthcare, education about the importance of breast self-exams, mm-hmm. for women. Because it's showing up so early in certain populations, in young premenopausal women, mm-hmm. It's very, very critical that they carry out regular self-exams or they visit their primary physician frequently and have all these factors assessed so that they get timely help or timely detection.
It always goes back to access, doesn't it?
It does. And
let's end as we talk about the conference. How much are you learning and talking? And although you've done some research around the globe, how fascinating is it and encouraging is it to bring all of these researchers and scientists from around the globe just to focus on triple negative breast cancer?
It has been such an enlightening and illuminating 2 days of talks. I have learned more in these 2 days than in 2 whole years of research at the bench, simply
really?
Because we have brought together people from so many disciplines and so many countries. We have 200 participants from 11 different countries. Some are high-income countries, low-income countries in 4 different continents. So they bring in expertise, experience, perspectives from diverse backgrounds. And it's clear that it's only through such collective and focused effort we have to make a global push and have, multi-institutional, large joint studies to tackle this challenging form of disease.
You know, it's a question I know that a lot of researchers, you know, they would love to be able to give me an answer when I say, you know, how far down the line do you think we'll be able to either have a treatment or something that effectively works? If you could look in your research crystal ball, what do you think?
So actually the question you're asking is how soon do you foresee finding cures
sure.
for hundreds of diseases?
Yeah.
So that, as you can imagine, that's pretty complex, but we've made tremendous progress in the past few years, and there are several ongoing clinical trials looking at potential new agents to target different subgroups amongst the triple negative breast cohorts to customize or individualize the treatments for patients based on their unique disease profiles.
And so research is going to be key for treatment as this relates to the racial disparities.
Absolutely. And to bridge the gap, we have to understand the disease first, and that's where research comes in.
Dr. Padmashree Rita, she's a senior research scientist at Georgia State University. We've been talking about the conference that's underway here. It's the first ever international conference.
Yes, you would think that is a surprise. Yes, we were the first to organize this right here in downtown Atlanta, we're proud to do that.
Well, thank you for all you do. Thank you for coming in and telling us about this. Fascinating.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Support for WABE comes from the law firm of Arnold Golden Gregory. The real estate attorneys of Arnold Golden Gregory help real estate owners, developers, lenders, and investors navigate legal challenges and opportunities. Arnold Golden Gregory, not if, but how. More at agg.com.
Tonight at 9 on PBA 30, host Michael Portillo travels on the great train routes of Europe as he retraces the journeys featured in George Bradshaw's 1913 Continental Railway Guide. Tonight, he ventures across Russia, Italy, and Poland, exploring sites and local traditions while creating a stunning vision of Europe as it was a century ago. Watch 3 hours of Great Continental Railway Journeys starting at 9 on PBA 30.
Community issues are what drives the conversations here on Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Tell me what's happening where you live. Send an email to rose@wabe.org. Again, that's rose@wabe.org. This is member supported 90.1 WABE Atlanta.
My name is Andrew Wortham. I live in the Capitol View section of Atlanta. What I like about my neighborhood is that it is accessible to most things. We have a central library. Well, the library is called the Metropolitan Library. And also I like that the neighborhood is improving as far as crime, and it's becoming a more beautiful neighborhood with the sidewalks and the paved streets and all that. And I think people are getting closer because of it.
When you're catching up on the day's news, the headlines are a good place to start. But to really understand the world and what's happening, you want the full story. All Things Considered takes the time to explore the details and differences to find meaning in the day's biggest stories. Stand with the facts. Listen every day. Join us weekday afternoons from 4 until 6:30 for All Things Considered here on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. We're going to continue now with more coverage of the deadly campus police-involved shooting of Georgia Tech student Scout Schultz. Now, there's a lot of legal questions already swirling as the investigation is underway by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. And joining me in studio is our WABE legal analyst, Paige Pate. Welcome. Good to see you.
Good afternoon, Rose.
You know, Paige, another police-involved shooting. We've talked about this issue before. But from your viewpoint, anything uniquely different thus far about this case?
Well, I do think the officers here are going to avoid any type of criminal responsibility for what they did. I think, obviously, you can look at it after the fact and say, well, they could have done something different. Perhaps they should have done something different. But legally, were they required to do anything different? And I think, given the circumstance, and I've seen the video, the officer was at least in a reasonable position to determine that they posed a threat to the officers at that point, because Scout refused to put the knife down. Even though the knife was not out, they weren't threatening anyone. I think ultimately the officers acted reasonably under the law, which is very different from what the law should be. But as the law currently is, I don't think they're going to be legally responsible.
I asked our earlier guest, retired Officer Marvin Reddick, his definition of clear and present threat as it relates to an officer and having to make that decision to shoot. And from a, because there is a legal definition about clear and present danger. I mean, technically, there
it's
is.
Muddy,
but it
yes,
is very muddy.
Is, right.
For our listening audience, can we define that as it is interpreted by the law?
Well, not in a way that's going to provide much guidance to officers. And I think that's the problem. Mm-hmm. It's always a case by case situation. Does the individual pose a threat to either the officers or some other people in the vicinity? And now you can't really write that out in a list of things. I mean, you all these protocols that we heard about earlier, the practices and procedures that departments have in place, they all attempt to define what the law doesn't define, and that is what is objective and reasonable in a situation like this when you're confronting an individual who may be armed and who may pose a threat. But there's no checklist. And so the officer, after the fact, the law questions, would a reasonable officer in the same set of circumstances do the same thing?
You saw the video, although, again, it's not surveillance, and it doesn't appear to be edited. And again, each situation is different. And we have videos before, cell phone or what have you video that's been taken before, but that doesn't seem to really be useful in a trial or a case because no one's really been convicted technically in terms of solely based on the video. But your thoughts on the video, does it show anything possibly that the officer did wrong?
Well, I think two things. I think there's evidence against the officer because it's clear to me that Scout is not trying to harm anyone. I don't think this was an issue of public safety. Yes, apparently Scout had a device that if they had unfolded it could actually be a knife that could have been used, but that's not what Scout was doing at the time. So I don't think Scout posed a threat to the officer. On the officer's side, however, I do think it's clear that the officers tried to advise Scout on numerous occasions to drop that device and not proceed any closer. So the officers were doing what they thought they should have done under the law, at that point at least, but then I don't think that Scout was posing an immediate threat to anyone.
Based on what you just said, are those components, is that what the GBI will be looking at in order to conclude whether or not it needs to go further to Paul Howard's office, the Fulton County District Attorney?
Yes, I think the GBI will start with the Georgia Tech policies and procedures for officers in a situation where they use force, especially deadly force, make sure that those policies were followed. They'll closely look at that. But a violation of a departmental policy does not mean someone's going to be charged with a crime.
Mm-hmm.
So if they determine that a policy was violated, then they'll move on to the next step. Was this officer's reaction reasonable given the circumstances? Did Scout pose enough of a threat because they did have a knife to the extent that the officer was justified in using deadly force? Those are the two questions they have to answer.
And that's not easy.
Not at all, no. Not even with a video, as you mentioned. The video doesn't tell the full story, although I think in this video we at least get to see the person who was shot as well as the officers, and we get to hear some of that dialogue. And that is not always the case with these officer-involved shootings.
And speaking of the video and the dialogue, and you hear Scout Schultz yell, you know, shoot me. Obviously, there's a whole lot there that we don't know. The GBI has also said they found suicide notes in Schultz's dorm room. Now, that leads to the speculation that maybe Scout Schultz intended for the outcome that happened to occur.
Right.
If this were to go to a trial, Paige, would that be helpful to the defense that this was an individual who wanted the outcome that unfortunately happened? Does that even matter?
Well, that's a great question. You know, perhaps to a jury that would matter, but legally, what's in Scout's mind, I don't think really does matter as to whether or not Scout posed an immediate threat to anyone in the area. We can judge that, and we're supposed to judge that from an objective standpoint, a reasonable officer standpoint. And obviously, the officers didn't know about any suicide note in the dorm room. They didn't know what may have been in Scout's mind at the time. All the officers knew is what they saw on the scene, and that's the type of analysis that a judge or a jury would have to do at a trial.
You are a criminal defense attorney.
I am.
You have defended officers who have been in a similar situation.
Yes.
Are there any similarities that you can think of in cases that you've handled here?
I've never had an officer convicted of an excessive force charge, and we've seen these cases across the country. I mean, St. Louis very mm-hmm. recently, even though it was an older case, the decision just came out last week, I believe. It is tough, very tough, to convict an officer of using excessive force, especially when there is some suggestion that the individual who was shot or injured was armed. So I think the officers, while there may be some civil liability that Georgia Tech is exposed to as a result of not providing these officers with some type of non-deadly force that they could have used in mm-hmm. that situation, I don't see the officers being criminally liable for what they did.
Well, you mentioned a civil lawsuit, and I guess the question, which you've already answered, is might Georgia Tech be held liable in a civil lawsuit? But before even getting to that, there are a number of factors. Depending on what the GBI is able to conclude, what could that have any effect on the civil lawsuit?
It could. I mean, again, the GBI is a criminal organization. I mean, they're an investigative body. They're focused on determining if there's any criminal responsibility, anyone to prosecute here. So they're going to look at the policies that were in place and then determine if the officers did something wrong. As far as Georgia Tech, that's going to be, I think, part of the civil lawsuit, although I don't think one's been filed. One has certainly been threatened by the mm-hmm. family's attorney. They're going to look at, did Georgia Tech act negligent in any way by not having policies and procedures in place to deal with mentally ill individuals in a situation like this who don't otherwise pose a threat to anyone. And again, I think if you look at this video as an objective person, I know it's after the fact, but I don't see Scout posing any danger to anyone. So why don't you give your officers the ability to use some other type of force to stop someone, to detain someone, to prevent them from either taking their own lives or someone else's?
If you're going to use the charge of they didn't have the policies in place, how challenging is that? Because we could have a lot of policies
right, sure.
in place no matter where you work. We have policies here at Public Broadcast in Atlanta or wherever. So how difficult is that?
Well, you're absolutely right. The test is not could Georgia Tech have done something different, or even should they have done something different, but did they do enough to meet a basic standard of what a educational institution of that size and of that complexity should have in place to deal with situations like this? Were they on notice that this type of a situation could occur? You know, that's going to be tough to show. They'll have experts come in and say, well, other colleges are doing this, some colleges are doing that. What is the standard that we should require?
Now, another factor that's already been brought up, Paige, is that whether or not Scout Schultz, is it a weapon? Okay, it's a utility sort of weapon that has all these other different little...
It's potentially a weapon.
It's a weapon.
Sure.
And his actions... advancing toward the officer, what was Scout's intent? All of those play into this as well. And if you are the GBI, you can't necessarily get inside of Scout's
no.
mindset.
And you're not supposed to. It's what the officers saw and what a reasonable officer would do in the face of that being a threat or not threat. You know, how did they perceive it? Did they perceive it accurately, or did they use excessive force? So you don't have to get inside his, mm-hmm. their head. You just have to focus on what the officer saw and then how the officer responded.
Because this was not a gun, Page, or a large sword, it was this small utility weapon, but it was a weapon. Could that play a part in what the GBI concludes as well in terms of the officer's perceived threat?
Absolutely. It's the totality of the circumstances. Scout could have had a firearm right there in Scout's pocket. Mm-hmm. But if the firearm had not been pulled out, was not being reached for, was not being brandished, then did Scout really pose a danger to the officer? So it's not just whether there was a weapon present, it's how was that weapon being used and how was Scout approaching these officers or other people in the area? Was he a danger at that point such that he needed to be stopped dead in his tracks?
You have said on this program before regarding a lot of not just Georgia laws, but laws in general in terms of what the law says and how it's interpreted, and then you use the word muddy today.
Sure.
As it relates to this, then what needs to be changed? What statutes need to be changed in relates to this? And I feel like you probably have a long list.
Well, because there's really no statute, and that's the problem. It's all case-based, and that's why it's all dependent upon the facts of a particular case, because the entire body of criminal liability for officers involved in excessive force cases or in deadly force cases, there is a statute that deals with deprivation of civil rights, and there are obviously criminal statutes on the state level that deal with aggravated assault, murder, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. But there's no specific statute, certainly not on the state level, that deals, I think, with officers in this type of situation in such a manner as it gives clear guidance to not just the officers, but to the public as well. This is what an officer can and cannot do. And the reason people will say we don't have that is because how can you do that? How can you draw up a list of things that present a danger in every context? That's very hard to do. But leaving it to a case-by-case determination doesn't give a whole lot of clarity to officers, and it doesn't help the public either.
And is that the case, Paige, in terms of why we do not see more convictions of officers?
That's part of it. But it's also, I think, the strong desire on behalf of juries and judges, as we saw in St. Louis, mm-hmm. to defend police officers. If there's a grain of doubt as to whether or not the officer acted reasonably, I think almost every decision maker in the cases that we've seen so far, they're going to give the benefit of the doubt to the officer. Very much on the side of law enforcement once you get these cases into trial and in front of a jury.
Any idea? The Georgia Bureau of Investigation said they're going to be thorough with this?
And they will be, I'm sure.
Could take months, you think?
It probably will. Again, it's a very narrow situation. I mean, we've seen the video. We know it didn't take place over a long period of time. They'll mm-hmm. obviously want to interview the officers. And those officers, as long as they're employed by the Georgia Tech Police Department or any law enforcement agency, they'll be required to give statements and to talk about what they perceived at the time. Although those statements can't later be used against them if they're charged in a crime. So they'll take those statements. They'll probably dig into Georgia Tech's policies and procedures and training. They'll certainly interview Scout's family, although that's not necessarily relevant to what the officers mm-hmm. thought. All that certainly can take time, but I don't expect it to last more than a year.
Is this a case where Scout Schultz's civil rights were violated?
I mean, that's the argument.
That's the argument, yeah.
I think, again, from a criminal standpoint, I think the answer is clear. I think no. I don't think these officers will be held criminally responsible for violating Scout's civil rights. On the civil side, it's a closer question because the burden is different. It's now just preponderance of the evidence. Scout's team would have to show a little bit more than not.
And that's different from beyond a reasonable doubt.
Very different. Preponderance is a much easier standard to meet for a plaintiff in a civil case than the prosecution in a criminal case trying to prove someone guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And then there's the issue of Georgia Tech, which would not be sued under a civil rights violation argument, but would be sued under simple negligence.
WABE legal analyst Paige Pate, as always, thanks for coming in and providing the legalese on all of this.
Well, thank you, Rose. Tragic situation, but
absolutely.
I'm glad we talked about it.
Thanks, Paige. That's it for today's edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Candace Wheeler, Ebony Lemon, and Finley Foxen. Our engineer is Elizabeth Eads. Our executive producer is Christine Dempsey. A special thanks to the entire WAB News team and Lisa Hagan for providing updates regarding the shooting death of Scout Schultz. Also, our digital services crew. If you missed any of today's show, you can find the entire program at wabe.org/closerlook. You can now listen to Closer Look weeknights at 9. We're back tomorrow at 1 for another edition of Closer Look. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.